It's time for another installment of Josh's Library Corner. Today, he's discussing the new Book Talk viral suspense thriller, Ask for Andrea, by Noelle W. Eiley. So, Josh, what did you think of Ask for Andrea?
I loved it. I just finished reading it this morning. It's the story of three women who are all murdered by the same man that they meet on a dating app. They all are murdered and wake up as spirits. They exist among the living, but they can't really do anything to communicate with them other than very slightly. But it's a story about how the three of them separately, and then they come together as the story goes on, try to solve their own murders.
Ooh.
And try to get the murderer arrested, caught for it.
That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, it was great. It's unique to see that conflict and struggle to try to affect something that's essentially impossible because they're dead and everyone else is alive. To see them figure out how to do that is really one of the coolest parts of the book. I was really satisfied with the conclusion. It was emotional, touching throughout. It was exciting, suspenseful. The emotions were real, even though the story is about the supernatural.
Thank you, Josh, for sharing your newest read from your library corner called Ask for Andrea. And as of October 28th, you can find the deluxe special edition trade paperback of Ask for Andrea with these gorgeous book edges wherever books are sold, but only for a limited time. While picking up your copy of Ask for Andrea at Books A Million, bookshop.org, or Thrift Books, or your favorite bookstore, check out the five other thriller suspense novels by author Noelle W. Eiley.
What it reads on the edge of the book is, "Dead Women Don't Forget."
Ooh.
It's a cool paperback.
If you've been listening to our more recent episodes, you've heard ads for newspapers.com. Usually, when we have an ad, it's because a company has sent in a request, we decide if we want to promote the item, and then we write the ad. In this case, we actually reached out to newspapers.com to see if they would want to partner with us. As you've heard in those spots, we are huge fans of the site. It's not only our number one resource when it comes to research, but we've used it for personal exploration or as a fun way to pass time. It's seriously like using Zillow, but instead of looking at houses, we are usually reading movie listings for a random Friday in the late 90s. Because I genuinely do enjoy finding cases and reading bizarre stories in old newspapers, I wanted to share a couple of tales that I found while doing research for other cases. It can be really hard to stay focused while on newspapers. I seriously have multiple documents of stories that I have found while researching other cases.
We call that research drift.
That's
in these
right.
parts.
It's so easy to do.
Yeah.
Because here I'm looking at this case, but what's this to the right about a judge calling off a what now? And now I got to read about that and look up that name. Ugh. Since now is a good time to support journalism, and we have a great promotion going on with newspapers.com, we wanted to throw in a contest for you guys also. So here's how it works. From now until January 30th, when you go to newspapers.com and sign up for your initial trial using the code MURDERINTHERAIN, which gets you 20% off, send us a screenshot via Instagram or our email, murderintherain@gmail.com. And everyone who sends in a screenshot will be entered into our random drawing, and you could win a swag bag of Murder in the Rain gear, including stickers, shirts, and a one-of-a-kind mug from friend of the show Steve Smith, among other goodies. And you'll also get swag and a one-year subscription from newspapers.com. So go sign up, send us the screenshot, and we will announce a winner in early February. Does that make sense?
Makes sense to me.
Sign up. Use our code. Send us the screenshot. You're in the drawing. Get some cool stuff. Get a year-long subscription.
I would like to live, this is the old man corner.
Uh-huh.
I would like to live in a world where people, instead of sending GIFs or images from the internet, they sent clippings from newspapers.com. Because you could just find the words you want to respond with, probably.
That's true.
In a headliner somewhere.
Well, you have to start it, old man corner. Start that trend.
I'm going to put a sound of like a rocking chair on a wooden deck.
For example, I just went into newspapers.com to find an article from 1933 that says, "Okay, old man." Gregory grinning down. "Haven't missed a thing. Here, catch." What the hell is this story?
Maybe that's the new segment. Is it's called "Okay, Old Man."
That's a good Patreon segment. Okay, Old Man. For this episode, I had originally planned on telling multiple shorter stories, and then I read one article. The headline was, "GIs Plead Not Guilty in Murder Hearings." Two Fort Lewis soldiers pleaded innocent in Superior Court today to unrelated first-degree murder charges stemming from the deaths last week of another soldier and a 28-year-old Graham housewife. Stephen Paul Chris, 19, offered his plea in the slaying last Thursday of Jacob Kim Brown, 22, an Army infantryman, whose bullet-riddled body was found in a ditch near Roy later in the day. Brown was reported to have left his Olympia home to meet a man for discussion of a debt. Trial of Chris was scheduled for November 29th by Judge James V. Ramsdell, who refused to set bail. Also pleading innocent was Sergeant First Class Richard Michael Wallingford, 33, of East Madison Street, who was accused of the gunshot slaying last Wednesday of Cindy Ann Barajas of 119th Avenue East Graham. Miss Barajas had been shot in the back of the head. Wallingford, whose arraignment was continued last Friday when he appeared in court in an apparently disassociative state, was scheduled for trial November 22nd. Bail was denied. Attorneys told the court Friday that the defendant had refused to give authorities anything more than his name, rank, and service serial number. Putting those key names into newspapers.com search engine, I was able to find out the stories surrounding both of these unusual cases, and I decided I would tell these stories. Finding these cases featuring stories of victims I've never heard of or read about is one of my favorite aspects of using newspapers.com. Today, I'll be telling you the stories of Jacob Brown, Peter Zito, Donald Barton, and Cindy Barajas, the forgotten victims lost to the back page. And I do want to make a quick note that while newspapers.com is a sponsor of the show, like they have purchased some ads with us, this episode is not part of that deal, and it's not an ad. We just really enjoy doing this foraging, if you will, and it really seemed like a fun and interesting way to present new cases. 19-year-old Stephen Paul Chris first appeared in newspapers in October 1976 when he pleaded not guilty to the murder of 22-year-old Jacob Kim Brown. His murder was discovered when a Fort Lewis soldier informed police officers that he knew of a fellow soldier who had been murdered and dumped in a ditch. Arriving in Roy, Washington, about 8 miles south of Fort Lewis, authorities discovered the body of infantryman Jacob Brown. Jacob was only 22 years old, but he was a father to his son, a husband to his wife, and a commanding officer to Stephen Chris. It was obvious Jacob had been murdered, and conveniently, a motive was known right away. It was reported Jacob had left his home in Olympia, Washington, and told his wife he was meeting up with some guy to get payment on a debt. In an unusual move, Pierce County, Washington sheriffs made an arrest the same day Jacob's body was found, and they charged Stephen with first-degree murder. Because Jacob's body was located on a portion of Hearts Lake Loop Road, which was part of a federal military reservation, the feds would be taking over the jurisdiction of the case, and Stephen would be facing federal charges. Without a lot of hubbub, Stephen's plea changed in December 1976, and he admitted guilt in the killing of Jacob Brown by shooting him in the head 5 times. The murder apparently stemmed from Stephen damaging Jacob's car at some point, and he owed him a few $100s for repairs. It seemed that instead of paying Jacob, Stephen decided to just kill him. This revelation earned a small blurb at the bottom of the 20th page of the paper. No details of evidence, no further information about the debt or why murder was better than paying. He was caught, he pleaded, and he was sentenced to life, probably because these were federal charges. And because they were federal charges, he was sent to a military prison. For the record, there were reports that said he was sentenced to both life and to 35 years. So either way, he was going to go away for a long time. Josh, you'll never guess how much time Stephen actually served for the cold-blooded murder of his commanding officer, Jacob, whom he apparently shot over an argument over money. How much of his 35-year-to-life sentence did he serve?
8 years.
That's a great guess. It's wrong.
1 year.
You're going the wrong way, but in other cases, you would not be wrong. He was paroled in 1988 after serving 12 whopping years.
I was pretty close.
You were not far. Yeah, 8 to 12, that's not bad.
I was a little too unreasonable.
Not by much, though.
No, and they
12
were just,
years out of life, that's...
The parole board or whatever was just fairly unreasonable.
Yes.
Thoughtless toward the community. I say let them out on day one. They think they're going to prison forever.
Trick them.
And then you just let them out and just see how if maybe that helps. Grateful. Unless it's murder.
Yeah, if it's murder, you get 8 to 12 years.
Max. Whatever you see, chop 2/3 off.
At least.
Crazy, man.
So that's Stephen's story. Right?
Certainly.
Of course it's not.
No, he went straight and never did another murder again.
Well, Stephen Paul Criss reappeared in the papers in 2022 and 2024. And to understand why, we have to go all the way back to 1974, 2 years before Jacob was murdered. Around 4 a.m. on October 3rd, 1974, a 17-year-old paperboy was making his rounds when he called the police to report seeing someone lying on the ground of the Oaks Hills parking lot and that another person appeared to be working on or lying upon the engine of a white 1956 Oldsmobile. Police arrived to find two Aloha High School students shot to death in the parking lot off of Sunnyside Road in Beaverton. For those unfamiliar, this incident occurred about 10 miles west of downtown Portland. It's believed 18-year-old Peter Zito Jr. and 16-year-old Donald Dean Barton were working on Peter's car when they were gunned down sometime between 1:30 and 3:35 a.m. Upon closer, more official examination, both boys had been shot in the head at close range with a small caliber weapon. One boy lay to the left of the vehicle, the other leaned over the right front fender. The carburetor had appeared to be the focus of their work as it was disassembled. Three shell casings were found at the scene, as were footprints, of which casts were made. There didn't appear to be a sign of a struggle. The proximity of the shooter told investigators that the boys may have known their assailant. Following up on their suspects and leads, it was learned a group of teens had gathered at the lot earlier in the evening, probably showing off their own cars, but almost everyone had gone home by 10 p.m. Josh, did you ever have the car guys? We did at our local Gresham Wendy's. You could drive by several times a week and see all the high school boys with their cars.
Yeah, I think on Friday nights, there was the Bob's Big Boy in Burbank. Every weekend at Bob's Big Boy, they would have a car show where everyone would bring their old, you know, whatever. And I had two friends that had classic cars, and so they would go down there, and I would go there sometimes and didn't enjoy it ever. I actually feel like I've been there. I haven't thought about this in forever. I went there a bunch and hated it every time because you just drive around this small parking lot, try to find a parking spot, you get out of your car, and you look at these dumb cars, and you're trapped. I also had to hang out with my friends that worked on their cars, and I always felt trapped. I just didn't care. I had an 86 Camry.
I'm here for the big boy burger.
Well, I mean, I would have been. I don't even know if we ever went in an 8. I have to smell these delicious burgers.
and talk car engines.
At this iconic California restaurant.
I'm sorry to have brought up an upsetting memory.
I saw David Arquette eating a sandwich there once.
Checking in with the boys' school, it was learned that both teenagers were in the process of dropping out of Aloha High. They weren't troublemakers who struggled with discipline, but they were called unmotivated. So much for not speaking ill of the dead, their principal, who said that in a newspaper.
What did he say?
That they were unmotivated. Like, give it a minute.
I want to know how long that principal had been principaling.
Oh, probably a very long time.
Well, if it wasn't a long time, I'd be very concerned. First year, these kids are
unmotivated. Except they're super into cars. So why don't you work on, hey, how can we get you in the direction of a trade to where you could just work on cars and still have an education and a job?
No, if they're not going to be.
You're unmotivated.
They're not doctors, lawyers.
You don't like to sit at a desk. You're unmotivated. Boo.
This is a crazy case. I've never heard of this kids being executed. Is this in the school parking lot?
This was a parking lot that sounded like maybe it was a large parking lot with multiple things, but it was known for the rec center of Oak Hills out in Beaverton. So I don't know if it was just for the rec center or if other things were there. But yes, they were just in a parking lot, like what every kid knows of for Friday nights, the high school car gathering. Everyone goes home around 10. These two boys are friends and still working on Peter's car.
And it's the middle of the night. You say it was like 3 o'clock.
They narrowed it down between like 1:30 to 3:30-ish.
Do they know if there was a breakdown of the vehicles or something? Is that why?
No, they were just tinkering. And the reason that investigators felt that they must have known the person was because it was such close range. And they were still apparently working on the car. So it wasn't like someone walked up to them and startled them and they were turned around and away from the car. Like, one was laying on the fender. Somebody walks up and says, "Oh, hey, man, what are you working on?" And then shoots them. Oak Hills didn't have much crime at the time, not even vandalism, according to a classmate. So who would know these boys well enough to be able to get close to them, but would be upset enough to kill both of them? That was the question police had to answer. When Peter Zito was a child, his family, including his sisters Barbara and Stephanie, moved from Long Island to Oregon for a new beginning. Stephanie said her brother was a happy and very kind guy who never did anything to anybody, and everyone loved Peter. Two teens being murdered made the front page, but after a few days, their story disappeared, coverage stopped, and the case went cold. Stephanie appreciated the attempts by police and investigators to find her brother's killer, but as the years went on and no arrests were made, she became more disheartened, though never with the detectives. To her, they were wonderful, but she had become fed up with other officials due to a lack of progress in the case. That's not to say that there were no suspects named or arrests made. In fact, later the same day the boys' bodies were discovered, fellow student Joseph Wilson was arrested. His alibi could not be corroborated. It would take 2 years for Joseph to be cleared of the killings, which would come January 14, 1975, the morning his trial was set to begin. So you're getting ready to go to trial for murder, for double homicide. And the morning you're going to trial, they go, "Oh, hey, we just dropped all the charges."
And you're free to go?
Yeah.
Gulp? Dump?
Yeah.
How do you, yeah, you can't, I don't know that you could ever recover from that sort of
whiplash. Yeah.
Emotional and, well, just your fate. You're fated to go to prison right now.
Right.
Good Lord.
And you know all along you haven't done anything, so the insane feeling of brain melt, I'm really going to trial. You know, everyone's biggest fear of somehow there's enough evidence, they're taking me to trial for murder. And then that morning, charges dropped. Sorry about all that. 2 years later, 2 years of his life that, oh, sick.
Thanks, everybody.
The charges being dropped was thanks to hand analysis that showed he had not fired a weapon, multiple past polygraphs, which were reviewed by 5 different experts, a lack of motive, and he didn't own a gun that matched the .22 caliber pistol used in the slayings. There was not a shred of evidence that tied him to the killings. Stephen Criss was also on police radar as a potential suspect not long after the murders. In December, 2 months after the shooting, Stephen was arrested for theft. At that time, Stephen had a .22 caliber handgun, which was confiscated until the theft case was closed. At that time, the ballistics were not a match. In 1976, Stephen joined the Army and was stationed at Fort Lewis in Washington. 2 years after Pete and Donald's murders was when Stephen killed Jacob in a similar manner, multiple shots to the head. At that time, he was still just a suspect for the double homicide because it was believed his .22 was not a match for the shells found at the scene. That was until 2022. When, for whatever reason, the Oregon State Crime Lab retested the shells and found that actually they had been a match for Stephen's gun. He was finally arrested for the murders of Peter Zito and Donald Barton. Knowing the gun was a match, investigators believed the boys were killed by accident, not accidentally shot, but that they were the wrong targets. Investigators said Stephen had been at the rec center of Oak Hills earlier on the day of the homicides and that he had been assaulted. Wanting to get even, he returned to the area and shot Peter and Donald, thinking they had been his attackers.
And that was the prosecution saying that?
Yeah, so that was the state's kind of the theory they laid out, was that something had happened with Stephen earlier in the day at the rec center. He went back pissed off, saw these two guys, maybe thought they were the two guys that assaulted him. I don't know what degree that was, you know, if somebody just roughed him up or if they really beat him down or something. And he approached them. So maybe because he was a fellow teen, they were like, "Oh, hey, man, what's up?" And him thinking that they were involved, he shot them. Stephen's defense team did not argue against that theory, instead deflecting their attention back to Joe Wilson, the original suspect. He's the guy that was spending 2 years waiting for his trial to start, and then the charges were dropped. Stephen's attorneys pointed out that he was known as Crazy Joe Wilson, and that he, quote, had a penchant for firearms and violence, and he was known to have pointed and fired his gun at strangers. They even argued Joe had been arguing with Peter and Donald at a party before being picked up by a cab near the area that would later be the crime scene. When the cab arrived, it was reported Joe had blood on his shoes, which supposedly matched the victim's. When asked about the cab ride, Joe said that he had been sleeping in the bushes. And I'm not sure if that's his reason for getting a ride from the area, like he'd been partying and drinking, or maybe why he had blood on him if he had cut himself on the bushes. The reason for the polygraphs, which Joe would end up passing, came when friends supposedly said that he had admitted to the murders. By the time Stephen's gun was declared a match to the shells, Joe had passed away from a heart attack at 43 years old, and Stephen's attorney claimed the police had lost Joe's bloody shoes, the polygraph results, and his gun. The DA's office did not deny that they had lost all of that evidence, and they just kind of played it off, saying, hey, the blood on those shoes could have been anybody's, which is true, but if you hadn't lost the evidence, they could have been tested so that you could make sure, you son of a... because I'm just going to put a beep here because that's going to be funny. It never gets old, Josh, hearing of lost evidence.
You have it. How on earth are you losing it? Isn't it in a room? Some fucking where? You can beep that.
I'm not. Here's what I want. We're going to fund police, but what we're going to fund is a super highest tech secure evidence room. And it's not going to be in little IKEA baskets where you just write your name if you feel like it to take something out. It will be so surveilled and documented, and every item will have a lock and a code.
And it should be that if the chain of evidence is going to be broken, it should be impossible for that to happen.
Yes.
The room should lock down. The cabinet should shut. It'll be on your whatever. You'll get penalized professionally for it. Whatever.
It should be hospital level. You know, at the hospital, they got to scan every single thing with your little personal barcode.
Yes, I do.
My IV, my wrist, my food, make a barcode for each case. And everything has to have that barcode and you have to scan it. It's just
fingerprint it, retinal scan,
anything,
cameras,
anything besides pen and paper.
And also thoroughly documenting
yes.
the actual evidence, like with photographs and
not having an inside guy working the door. That should be a third party security company, former Secret Service people or something. Mm-hmm. It should not be your buddy who brings you coffee and a donut so you look the other way. I've had it.
I, too, have had it.
And we get to talk about it in our next episode.
It's so stupid, too, to lose evidence because don't you want to solve them?
And isn't that why you'd spent all that time and effort in collecting said evidence? Don't you want to close your case? Don't you want to prove all the work you did and say, look, we've got his bloody shoes. Now we have the technology. We can test it. Oh, it was his own blood. Okay. Now we know we are punishing the right person for this crime. Moving forward with the charges against Stephen, the DA tested the shells from the parking lot and the ditch where Jacob was found, and they were a match. For the defense, this felt like the DA had fouled up the case against Crazy Joe and was looking to pin it on someone, and they landed on Stephen. Though he had shot someone in the head and his gun was a match, so I feel like it's more about a mishandling of a case than a framing, but it's just a mess, the whole thing. Since there was such little evidence pointing to Stephen as the shooter, besides what was previously mentioned, prosecutors had one key to assure closing their case: Mike Alexander. From what I can tell, Mike may have been in prison with Stephen when he was serving time for Jacob's murder. While there, he allegedly bragged, confessed, depending on who you're talking to murdering Peter and Donald. In early 2023, as the trial was inching closer, the defense scored break after break. First, a judge ruled against what little evidence there was, stating there had been a change in search and seizure laws from the time the case took place to the trial, so some evidence wouldn't be allowed. But the biggest blow to the state's case came in late 2023, early 2024, when Mike Alexander, the key witness, died. Without his testimony claiming Stephen had admitted to shooting the boys, the prosecution was left with shell casings. And while they were a match in the lab, the match did not meet the scientific benchmarks set by the Oregon Supreme Court to be a legal match. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So it's whatever percentage in a lab, maybe it's only 50 or 60%, and they can say a match. Whereas in court, I don't know the numbers, but maybe it's 80 or 90% a match to be able to be brought in as evidence. And they just didn't have that. On January 18th, 2024, all charges against Steve and Chris were dropped. Stephanie Zito learned her brother's possible murderer wouldn't be tried via a phone call from the DA. According to her, the reason Stephen was let out of military prison early was because he had ratted on someone, even though it was believed that he had bragged to inmates about what he had done to all of his victims. Stephanie said, quote, "I believe that the DA really wanted to wash his hands of this case in January 2024 and really did not care about seeing justice for my brother Peter and Don. I also believe that his decision was with prejudice. I had also written to the Oregon Attorney General and Governor, and both ignored me," only adding to her feeling that Oregon's laws are, quote, "such a joke that it's laughable." For more on Stephanie's story and the loss of her brother Peter, you can read her book, Legend of the Unforeseen. So that's what I found after stumbling upon that article about Steve and Chris, who, as far as I can tell, is a free man living his life in Oregon, which is fair, right? Innocent until proven guilty. And they couldn't prove that he was the responsible party.
But
it's a tricky one.
It's, yes.
And it's done. You know, no one's going to go back and go, all right, back to the drawing board.
Impossible.
All these years later, we didn't get that guy. Let's see what else we can find. No, we don't have the blood evidence. You don't have the gun of the other guy. It's done. It doesn't seem like Stephanie and her family or Donald's family will ever have answers or something resembling justice for those murders. That same initial article introduced me to Sergeant Airman First Class Richard Michael Wallingford. Because newspapers pulls everything that matches keywords, I can tell you that Richard Wallingford joined the Army in 1960 and was sent to Fort Ord in California on the south end of Monterey Bay. In 1962, he married Dixie Cheryl Keinbaum. The wedding would be taking place in Mainz, Germany, where Richard would be stationed, and the young couple looked forward to starting their new married life. At some point in his military career, Richard and his wife Dixie were relocated to Fort Lewis in Washington. In 1976, Richard was living 14 miles as the crow flies, 20 miles as the car drives, from Graham, Washington. In Graham, in 1976, lived 27-year-old Cindy Ann Barajas with her husband of 9 years, Clyde, and their 5-year-old daughter, Kelly. Cindy had attended Puyallup High School, just 10 miles north of her new home. After attending the University of Washington in Seattle, she was a secretary for 9 years. In October of 76, Cindy and Clyde had just come home from a vacation in North Dakota. They were nearing completion of their new home located on a dirt and gravel road her father, Bill Wood, had built. She was doing well at work. Things were just really coming together for Cindy's life. She was smart, especially when it came to business and machines. She was happy. The happy times would end on October 6th. The morning started as usual. Clyde, Kelly, and Cindy had breakfast together before he left for work about 8:10 a.m. Cindy was home with Kelly. Nothing seemed out of the ordinary until 2 p.m. when Cindy's mother, Evelyn, drove past her daughter's home and saw her grandbaby, Kelly, waving from a window, still in her pajamas. The sight was alarming as Kelly wasn't normally in her pajamas far into the afternoon. Evelyn parked and walked to the front door. Kelly let her grandma in, and when asked about her mother, Kelly said that she was sleeping in the other room. Evelyn went into the back bedroom and found her daughter lying across the bed with a pillowcase and pillow slightly over her head. She reached out to touch Cindy, and she was cold. Evelyn left, seeking help. Neighbors entered the home, finding Cindy's body, still in her nightgown, which had been ripped up the front. She, face down on her bed in a pool of blood, with her hands bound behind her back with a belt. Her face had been battered, her lips were split, and she had been shot twice in the back of the head with a .38 caliber weapon sometime between 8 a.m. and noon. One report did state that she had been sexually assaulted. Police arrived at the scene and started processing the homicide. Since her parents lived on the same street, Cindy's father was heard crying to a neighbor. They took her and shot her in the head. unbearable news for him to share and for the friend to hear. As her father watched on in horror and disbelief, a small white bundle laid on a stretcher as it was rolled out the door by the coroner. The coroner and investigators explored the home and scene while police officers did a sweep of the neighborhood, questioning neighbors, looking for anyone who may have seen or heard something. 2 hours later, at 4 p.m., a call was made to Midland Police, an area 10 miles north of where Cindy had been killed. Investigators and Graham had no idea that that call was connected to their case, but they would soon learn it was. The call in Midland was about a man who was sitting in a parked truck in a driveway. The concern was that he was claiming to be suicidal and intervention was needed. Arriving to the home on East Madison Street, police found a large, despondent man sitting in the driver's seat of his truck. He claimed he was planning to turn himself into a human torch. The man was Richard Wallingford. Richard had been going through a tough time in the previous weeks, alluding to suicidal ideation, especially when he drank, an issue possibly related to his time serving in Vietnam. On the morning of the 6th, he had told his wife Dixie to take the kids and leave as he would be taking his life. She didn't leave, instead staying and trying to help. Richard cried to her, saying he had hurt someone, but when she asked questions, he said he couldn't remember. Richard then doused his clothing in gasoline, walked outside, and laid on a burn pile in the yard with a torch in his hand. At some point, Dixie called Richard's brother and the police in hopes that any of them could help. Richard's brother arrived from Vancouver and found him sitting in the truck. Police hoped that having a family member involved could de-escalate the situation, so they watched from afar with binoculars as he tried to talk to Richard through the driver's side window. When it appeared Richard's hands were empty, three deputies rushed the vehicle. Surrounding the truck, one officer smashed the passenger window so he and another officer at the open driver's side window could douse Richard with flame retardant. At the same time, a third officer snuck up and unlocked the door. Once Richard was out of the truck, a deputy wiped his face and asked him why he was attempting to kill himself. Richard said it was because he had killed somebody. The deputy pushed for information on who he had killed. Richard said he didn't want to talk about it. Richard was arrested on the scene and a 5-gallon gas container was recovered. That same deputy who wiped Richard's face then went into the home he shared with Dixie, where he found a .38 caliber pistol. The gun was loaded with 4 rounds, 2 had been fired. On Friday, October 8th, Richard was officially charged with the first-degree murder of Cindy Ann Barajas. Between questions from police and court appearances, Richard would only state his name, rank, and service serial number. He was sent to jail without bail. On October 12th, he entered a not guilty plea. That court appearance ended in a continuance and a photo being taken that shows just how large Richard was. This photo is on our blog, but for now, I want you to imagine Edmund Kemper's huge body with actor Barry Keoghan's head. Richard was barefoot, shackled, standing a menacing 6'4" and 250 pounds. By the end of October, Richard's trial was moved from November 19th to December 13th.
He's huge, but his head looks kind of small.
Yes, a little bit.
Oh my God, he does look like Barry Keoghan.
Right?
Yes.
He could play him if he wasn't
witty.
Little boy.
Yeah, a little boy.
So yeah, imagine that dude being drunk and extremely distraught, threatening his life, threatening others. It would be very scary.
He was the one that was covered in gasoline?
He was the one sitting in the truck covered in gasoline. Yeah. And was charged with Cindy's murder.
He kind of looks like Harlan Williams.
Oh, a little bit. The ears, definitely. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The trial was then bumped to January 10th, 1977. During opening statements, the state promised to provide evidence that the gun recovered from Richard's home was a ballistics match to the casings removed from Cindy. That might have seemed like a slam dunk, but the defense had a twist of their own. Richard was going to change his plea from not guilty to insanity. The 7-women, 5-men jury heard the defense open with information about at least 2 instances of suicidal ideation Richard had expressed in the week leading up to the murder, and that it was insanity that had him threatening to turn himself into a human torch. The first witness for the state was sex worker Kathy Evans. She testified that the morning of the murder, she had been at her home with Richard. While there, he pulled out his gun but did not fire it. Kathy had been hired by Richard on at least 2 other occasions before that day. On the first, Richard was unable to perform. On the second, he was nervous, but it didn't seem to be from performance anxiety. Kathy said Richard expressed a paranoid fear of being followed, so he left. The second witness was Clyde, Cindy's husband. He tearfully recounted the final morning he spent with his family before his wife was taken from him, describing her as having a, quote, heart of gold, and saying, "There are so many good people in the world. She was one of those. She loved children. She loved life. And she loved me. A witness that adds to the chilling nature of the crime was Emily Webster. She lived in the same neighborhood as Cindy. On that Tuesday morning, a knock at the front door interrupted the breakfast she was feeding her two children. Answering the door, she found Richard standing in her doorway. Richard inquired about directions to a local housing development. I'm not sure if Emily knew the answer or just blew him off. After that inquiry, he asked if he could use her bathroom. I didn't find if she let him in, but I'm just assuming that she did not. 15 minutes later, there was another knock. When Emily answered, and it was Richard again, he asked to use her telephone. She slammed the door in his face. I know we've not visited Earl Nelson, which is a case I've been researching for several years now, but he had a similar MO. He would knock on doors to ask housewives about using their phone, getting directions, if they had food. And it was really a way for him to kind of read the house before entering, you know, if there were any children there, if there was a man there. So, ladies, one more thing to the list. You can't answer your own front door.
That's always been my stance.
Yes, you're very good at that.
I am anti-answering the front door. I don't open it.
There's no need.
I will ice out a beloved family member if they haven't announced themselves as coming over. Thank you.
That's fair. And the thing with this that makes Emily's story kind of even creepier or scarier that it is we know from Cindy's murder that he had no issue with children bearing witness to his horrors.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So it didn't matter that she had two children that she was feeding. So thank goodness that she slammed the door in his face. The state continued to present their evidence. The ballistics matched. Gunpowder residue was on his hands, indicating he had recently fired a weapon. The defense had Dixie's elderly father, who came to the stand to say that Richard had called him to confess to killing someone, but he was certain that that call was on the 5th, the day before the shootings. Everyone tried to correct him, but he was certain that that call was on the 5th. So that's not exactly a good or strong defense. They just had a guy that was like, oh, he called and confessed, but it was a different day. It was kind of moot. To push their insanity argument, the defense showed that there were no previous connections or interactions between Richard and Cindy. He claimed to have been so drunk that he couldn't even remember having seen her that day. The state, they argued that what they think happened was maybe he did the same thing going to the door, but they felt it escalated because maybe he made some sort of move or tried to force himself in the house or something, and she said no, and that sent him over the edge. Mm-hmm. But there's no telling because he claims to be so drunk he remembers nothing. The defense also brought in character witnesses who claimed that Richard was a leader among men, a man who was good to his children, and an exemplary soldier. Those witnesses did not help, and on January 17th, Richard Michael Wallingford was found guilty of first-degree murder after the jury took 2.5 hours to deliberate. On January 27th, 1977, Richard was sentenced to life in prison for the killing of Cindy Barajas. He would be up for parole after 13 years. In 1978, Dixie filed for divorce against Richard. In 1990, Richard's name was back in the newspapers as his 13-year minimum was reached, just as the Intermediate Sentence Review Board would be revisiting his case, along with 27 others, due to a change in sentencing laws in 1984. I was unable to find information about Richard's current status as to whether he was still in prison or if he served any kind of reasonable time or if he's even still alive. So I reached out to Washington State Records and they got back to me so quickly. Thank you guys very much. And they gave me somewhat of an answer. They informed me that they aren't sure if Richard is alive. He would be 82 years old now if he is. And according to their records, he did serve time in their prisons from 1977 until September of 1994, making it appear Richard served 17 whole years for entering Cindy's home, attacking her physically and sexually before brutally murdering her in front of her child. So some justice being served. And I'm not sure if that 17 years came 4 years after the sentence review, if that board was looking at those new rules and decided, or he hit his 13-year minimum and wasn't quite ready for parole and needed just a couple more years to simmer.
That's good. That's a good sentence.
I'm glad he got out in the mid-90s. That's good for everybody.
Yeah, 30 years ago, he could have been doing all sorts of shit. And there's no record of his death.
I couldn't find anything. Ancestry, newspapers, Google. I'm just not sure. So I don't know if he changed his name in the 90s and skipped out, if he died long ago, if he left the country. I just can't tell.
Well, if anyone's seen him, they would remember.
That's true. If you have seen a 6'4" Barry Keoghan, that's the guy.
Maybe barefoot.
Possibly barefoot, like he liked to be. And he'd be 82, so maybe he'd be closer to 6'2". You know, old people, they get a little smaller. So there you go. If you do, if by some miracle you happen to know what came of Richard, if he ended up living longer, if he is still alive, if you know about Richard Wallingford, please let us know. That'd be super awesome. And on a random note, I was perusing some of our fellow podcasters, and I just happened to see that our friends Military Murder, they just covered the story of Stephen Criss like 2 weeks ago. So if you really want to get the entire story, listen to this episode, then go check out Military Murder and their coverage.
What a good coincidence.
Isn't that bizarre?
Yeah.
I was looking up, I think I was trying to find a photo for the blog or something, and then it came up. I'm like, oh, fun, Military Murder. Oh, of course she did. It's GIs. Like, that makes sense. And then I saw, I was like, November 7th? What? So great minds find the same information at the same time, as the saying goes. So those are the two stories that I found from just one clipping on newspapers.com. Because of their extensive library, we are always able to find those delicious, random, smaller details that really help to paint a picture of the cases that we're covering. And literally yesterday, Josh and I were talking about newspapers.com because we just want to get the word out to people as a resource. Anyone doing research, you don't need ChatGPT. You don't need to just do Google or hope for the best with a couple resources. There is so much at your fingertips at newspapers.com. It's just a real delight. I've randomly sent friends pictures of them like in high school when they were in the paper. Now we have on our mantle a picture of my grandmother in her wedding dress, which is a photo I never saw. I don't think anyone has, but there was a wedding announcement in the paper. So I got to see a picture of Grandmere in her wedding dress. So it's those special little things that can get lost so easily in bigger pictures.
And it's just a reliable source of information. You can depend on what you're reading there.
Mm-hmm. And counter it. I've definitely had times where it's like, oh, I've often found it interesting on how differences are reported.
Mm-hmm.
Where you go, oh, why did this journalist think the name was this? Or, well, where did they get that date? Because the other thing says this date. I've definitely realized our history is through humans and humans are flawed. So
there's always a filter there.
Yeah. So just using the different articles to piece it all together
right.
to go, this is the story.
Yeah. The vastness of the sources that you can find, it really helps with your accuracy. Boy, I love it. It's fun to also look at a newspaper without getting any ink on your fingers.
But what about my silly putty? So again, that was from one clipping. I found two names and I found all that information. All of our resources via newspapers.com will be on our blog. And don't forget to enter the contest. You just got to go sign up, do a shorter term, do a trial, do something, use our code Murder in the Rain. Send us that screenshot that you did that and we'll enter you. Maybe you win a year subscription. Maybe you win some stuff from us.
It could change your life.
It could change your life.
And the...
We guarantee it.
Did you mention the mug?
I did. I didn't go into detail.
No. I don't want to either. They are unique pieces. There are no others on the planet.
Handmade individually.
And they are personalized for the show. They're beautiful. And they have special accoutrements that you won't see on a regular coffee mug.
That's right.
I guarantee it. They're huge. Two dorks talking about a website.
Of newspapers.
It's pretty cool. It is cool.
It is.
Old man.
Also a great gift.
I'd love it.
Something to think about. It's holiday season. You know, maybe you've got somebody in your life that likes to, I don't know, they're a history buff.
You got a family member that wants to do some archiving, some historical stuff. You got a nerdy kid that likes to look up things from the past.
Well, and it is connected to ancestry. So when you're in ancestry, if you have a newspaper subscription, you'll also get all those news clippings about the person. And they all come together to tell a story. So it's a great gift if you've got somebody who's into that.
Pretty neat, if you ask me.
That's right.
The old guy. Cut that out.
Newspapers.com. The past. Read all about it.
Did you just make that up?
No, that's their tagline.
Oh, that's a good one. Gobble to all.
It's turkey time.
It's turkey time. It's a new way to communicate with older things that are made of that were made of paper once. Newspapers.
Oh, here's a comic from 1938. I don't see how anyone could have come out of that alive. Are you okay, old man?
I'm not. I want people to communicate with newspaper clippings like kidnappers.
It's also pretty short, so any beefing is good.
Any beefing?
Yeah.
Wow. Plumps when we cook it.
Ew.
Plumps when we cook it. Oof. Oh. Plumps when we cook it.
You have to stop.
No, I had to say it thrice.
Oh. Why?
Because I want the plump wiener to appear like Beetlejuice. Wiener juice, wiener juice, wiener juice.
That is demonic. Wiener juice? I'm trying to work here.
You got to keep up morale, you know? Newspapers.com should use the word foraging more in their in their ad copy. That was a good word use right there.
Thank you.
I like it. You can't talk over my sound effects all the time. How am I going to become the next Michael Winslow if you don't let my art out? Thank you. The double-edged sword of the rec center. It must always be saved, and kids are always getting into horrible trouble there.
Yes. There is so much at your fingerprints. Fingerprints?
Those were the days, huh?
Sunday morning.
Oh, man.
Silly putty. Welcome to Old People Corner. I used to sit with my dad and put silly putty on the comics.
Yeah, I used to do that with my folks. Look at it. Look at Ziggy.
Look at Ziggy. Look at him.
Behold Ziggy. And is Andy Cap abusive? What's going on there?
Oof.
Didn't like him.
Mm-mm.
Can't see his eyes. He's hiding something.
He is.
It's been a rough few weeks. Fucking November. It's my birth month. I got to deal with all this shit.